When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by our Patreon supporters, Robin Brown, Skylar Collins,
Julie Gray,
Bree Smith, Janelise Cannon, Maria Carla Sanchez, Jamie Lang, Valerie Jacobson, Jill Harrigan, Heather McKinnon, Chantel Oliver, and Lindsay Cummings. You can help support the podcast for as little as $1 a month. Just visit our website at whatsyournamepodcast.com and click donate. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Olivia.
Today, we are going to talk about, I'm just going to boldly state this because I genuinely believe it's true. Today, we are going to talk about the most important, most influential, most measurably enormous impact on regular Americans' daily lives having woman in U.S. history.
That is a very bold statement.
I know.
Wow. Do you know how many historians you have up in arms right now?
Yes, and this is my hill, and on it I shall die.
Fascinating. All right, make your case.
I would say she is unquestionably the most measurably enormous impact on regular Americans' daily lives having woman of the 20th century. And possibly, this is really going to make people mad, the most enormous impact on regular Americans' daily lives having person of the past 100 years.
Okay. Not that it's a contest. It's not like somebody wins history.
And yet, she is appallingly unfamous compared to the amount of stuff she accomplished and the contributions that she made to humanity in her lifetime.
Okay.
Sure, there's, you know, the dedicated political history nerds who know who she is, and the enthusiastic social justice warrior fangirls. Every Washington, D.C.-based employee of the U.S. Department of Labor knows her name.
Okay.
Because it's the name on the building where they go to work every day.
Oh. Well, then I had my inklings, but now I know for sure who we're talking about.
People may have picked up on the fact that I like her a lot.
Yes. You've got her up on that pedestal all the way.
I have been waiting 74 months to do an episode on her. Yes, it is finally time for me to introduce the What's Her Name listening world to the first female cabinet secretary in U.S. history, indomitable champion of humanity, and my own personal hero and exemplar, Frances Perkins.
Woo-hoo!
I'm Olivia Mickle.
And I'm Katie Nelson.
And this is What's Her Name?
Fascinating women you've never heard of.
Joining me in fangirling all over Frances Perkins is acclaimed author Stephanie Dre.
Hi, everybody. I am Stephanie Dre. If you have read my books before, My Dear Hamilton about Eliza Hamilton and America's First Daughter about Thomas Jefferson's daughter, Patsy, you know that I love writing about revolutionary women and founding mothers of the country. And now I am back again with a brand new book about another revolutionary woman who's actually a founding mother of the 20th century, Frances Perkins. And I can't wait for you to learn all about her.
Many of our readers have probably heard of or read some of Stephanie Dre's books. She's a New York Times bestselling author. She's also one of the authors of a book that I know you love as much as I do, Katie, Ribbons of Scarlet.
Oh my gosh.
About the women of the French Revolution.
No way.
Amazing stuff.
Order it yesterday. You're gonna love it.
Her new novel, which came out yesterday, is called Becoming Madam Secretary.
Cool.
I believe Frances Perkins was the most important woman in American history. even though we have so many wonderfully important American women in our history, I can't think of any woman whose influence is as widespread and so lasting as to define an entire American century. I can't think of another cabinet officer who is as consequential as her without going back to Alexander Hamilton. So that is why I had to write about her and why I think she's so legendary.
Frances Perkins was born Fanny Coralie Perkins in 1880. This is an extremely wealthy, privileged, conservative, Mayflower ancestor, New England family. And they were very big on the idea that God had put people where he wanted them to be.
Mm-hmm.
And he intended them to stay there. Not necessarily location-wise, but certainly place in society-wise. Thank goodness. Frances did not agree with her parents on that matter. Starting from a very young age, she was questioning that fundamental principle of Congregationalist Maine society. There's an amazing story when Fanny first enters school and she first encounters poverty. And she's appalled. She had no idea that this was happening. She came home and asked her parents why nice people could be poor. Her parents very quickly gave her the accepted answers of their race and status and class. That poverty was the result of alcohol or laziness. These are the only reasons anyone is poor. And then her father sternly told her that little girls should not concern themselves with such things and ended the conversation.
Okay.
She remembered that conversation for the rest of her life. And it seems like it planted the first seed of uncomfiness with the way the world was being explained to her.
Mm.
Frances was very proud of her revolutionary history. Her family counted many revolutionaries in their past, including Mercy Otis Warren. She was a revolutionary and kind of the historian of the American Revolution. She had these people at the founding of the United States, but also a sort of refounding of the United States during the Civil War. Her uncle was a Union general who went on to found Howard University for Black Americans. And so Frances grew up with patriotism in her bloodline. She always felt that her family had helped build the country and had helped save the country, and that she had a role to play, which is a lot for a little girl growing up at the turn of the century to think.
Going against the prevailing tide of her day, off she went to Mount Holyoke College, where she was expected to learn some social graces and then return home and marry the nice rich boy of her parents' choosing. Her professors recognized an unusually brilliant mind and an unusually determined frame and insisted that she major in chemistry and physics.
Wow.
Taking only the hardest classes available in the whole college, and she graduated with a double degree in 1902.
Wow, cool.
While there, she was also elected president of her class. She was a very popular student, very engaged in the social life of Mount Holyoke. This will be very surprising to those people who do know her story and her life, because Frances Perkins is firmly ensconced in history as a dowdy, frumpy, grumpy, maybe matronly drag. She might get a lot done, but she wouldn't be fun to be around while you were getting those things done. And that's just incredibly not accurate. Part of what creates that general impression of this frumpy, unfashionable, perpetually older woman is, in my opinion, the hat. Capital letters. She was famously always wearing very sort of old-fashioned old lady hats. And they became really identified with her image as this very formal, buttoned-up, stodgy woman. And the hat, capital letters, is pretty clearly a direct result of another piece of parental instruction she received very early in her childhood. At the age of 10, she entered a hat shop with her mother, and her mother sat her down and told her that she would never be a beauty. And she was totally unable to carry the fashionable hats of the day, and plunked down an old-fashioned tricorn hat, right? A George Washington hat, the most out-of-fashion hat imaginable at that point, on her daughter's head and said, "This is the only hat that you should ever wear."
Fascinating.
This is absolute nonsense, by the way. She's absolutely lovely as a child, as a woman, and not that that matters, but she was. And for some reason, her mother refused to see it or refused to admit it, and she made sure that Frances couldn't see it either.
Interesting.
You will see her wearing that George Washington hat for the rest of her life.
Wow.
I did know she was our very first female in a presidential cabinet in the United States. But I always had sort of the impression that she was this sort of dowdy, boring lady. I didn't think of her as being dynamic enough to maybe merit a novel. Well, the egg is on my face, because when Laura Kamoy, my very dear friend and sometimes co-author, and I were doing a little preliminary research on the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, I encountered a much younger Frances Perkins, somebody who was stylish and spunky and full of daring and definitely not a stodgy old lady. I got excited by the story of her as a young woman, which was quite a spitfire, quite courageous and daring. And I thought, oh my God, isn't this just the arrogance of youth? You think, you know, that older people were never young. And I was so embarrassed by this and by what I learned about her. I knew I had to write about her.
So here she is earning degrees in chemistry and physics, but her personal interests were always more in humanity. Frances Perkins spent a lot of time during her time at Mount Holyoke out in the community and observing the conditions faced by workers in the mills of Holyoke, Massachusetts.
Oh.
Now, we have been on one of our tours to the Massachusetts mills. Uh-huh. Like, these were dreadful conditions. They were incredibly dangerous and pretty miserable. And there are children working in these mills.
Hmm.
That little girl who wondered why nice people could be poor is absolutely horrified at what she's seeing here.
These were things that Frances had never really encountered before. She didn't have any personal experience with this, but she had enough feeling of her own identity and her own connection to the American story that she believed she couldn't love America without loving the American people. So she felt called to do something to help.
And when a well-known activist named Florence Kelly, who was from the National Consumers League, came and gave a speech at Mount Holyoke on the need for social supports for poverty remediation, labor reform, Frances was absolutely spellbound. She said later that Florence Kelly's speech first opened my mind to the necessity of and the possibility of the work which became my vocation.
Huh.
It was one of those record scratch moments for her. And although she was sometimes a little dismissive about her own work and this feeling that she had of vocation, of calling, I think it really was that for her. She once said, I knew I had to do something. It was sort of up to me. This feeling sprang out of a period of great philosophical confusion which overtakes all young people.
What am I going to do with my life? How am I going to leave my mark and make a difference?
And that feeling of the world rides on my shoulders, as someone who definitely struggled with that exact same impulse for many, many years of my life, still does. That self-awareness of how arrogant and ridiculous of me to go, yes, it's all up to me.
Mm.
And also still feeling that pull of, but what if it's all up to me and I don't do it?
And this was only furthered by Theodore Roosevelt, who made a speech in which he called upon Americans, particularly those who were descendants of the founders, to address the problems in the nation that had come about due to the rise of industrialization. She took that personally. She thought that was a mission that she had to answer.
So her parents had been happy to indulge this whole college thing up to a point. They valued education. They recognized Frances as a remarkable, intelligent mind. But when Fanny Perkins graduated from Mount Holyoke, she was supposed to come home and teach in a school or work with the Congregationalist Church until a suitable marriage prospect appeared. And Fanny had other ideas. She promptly moved to Chicago, changed her name to the much more dignified Frances, was baptized into the Episcopal Church.
Oh, dang.
Completely rejecting her family's religious beliefs and affiliations, and began working at Chicago Commons and Hull House.
Uh-huh.
These are two of the most well-known and oldest settlement houses in the country.
I was just going to say, this is golden era of reforming women, fixing poor people's lives. Is that why she moved there? She's like, Jane Addams, I'm coming.
Yes, she told her parents she was going to teach, which she did, briefly, in a posh girls' school.
And while she was in Chicago, she decided to volunteer with Jane Addams. And that's when she really became involved in the early social work scene. And from there, she became more and more committed to the cause.
She moved into Hull House.
Oh, wow.
And was living on site, working full time on fixing poverty. So settlement houses were kind of a combination of housing projects and community centers and schools. They were shared space and work and education and service space for the poor and the unemployed. But often there are like high-minded, wealthy women working and living in those spaces, trying to reform the world.
Yeah.
And there she was in her element. She realized that she could do this and that she needed a lot more experience and knowledge to do this effectively. So she went back to school. And in 1909, she begins first a fellowship with the New York School of Philanthropy, and then a master's degree in sociology and economics at Columbia University. She continues her work in social work, gets really involved in labor reform. Again, seeing those children in the mills, seeing the poverty, the catastrophic injuries that happen to children when they're working in environments like this. And she starts to get more involved in other social issues like prostitution, human trafficking. There is an amazing story of Frances setting out on some field work in Philadelphia.
I can't believe she did this, but she would go undercover to bust pimps and human traffickers. She was very courageous. The thugs even caught up with her at some point and they attacked her at night, and she stood her ground and sort of chased them up with a parasol.
She's out here whacking gangsters with her parasol in the streets and shouting out their names. I know you, John Jones. I recognize you. Until they finally get spooked and take off running. She's so just kind of unhinged and fearless here.
All right.
I mean, this is the kind of heroine who is lots of fun and not at all like the stodgy image that she would prefer us to remember.
While she was in Philadelphia, she also became extremely active in the women's suffrage movement. She was famous for her fervent street corner speeches on the need to improve the lives and protect the rights of immigrant women and girls. And she enrolled in school again, this time studying economics and sociology at Wharton, the most prestigious business school in the country. And then, in March 1911, Frances is having tea with friends in New York City's Washington Square when they heard fire engines outside. And standing on that street, Frances Perkins watched in horror as 47 workers, mostly young women, jumped from the 8th and 9th floors of a building to their deaths.
Oh.
This is the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire.
She was there? Dang.
She was in front of the building watching it happen.
Her life is like a narrative of Gilded Age America. She's like,
yeah, it's
all the things in the books.
She's the Forrest Gump.
Yes, totally. Crazy.
This was one terrible tragedy that happened where building caught fire and a bunch of mostly women working in the factory there died. Fires like this were happening all over the place. And people like Frances and other reformers were already complaining about this and trying to draw attention to this. In fact, the very women who were working at the factory had already protested their working conditions. They had tried to seek redress. They had been ignored. And then on this one fateful day, a fire broke out in the factory, and the factory owner had locked them in the room. There was no way out, and they had to make the terrible choice whether to burn alive or jump to their death. What was different about this is that it happened in the middle of New York. It was witnessed by many people. She witnessed these people hanging from windows by their fingertips, trying to make peace with their deaths before they leapt to the ground because there was no way to save them. And I must say, one of the worst parts of writing this book is that I spent a day looking at pictures of corpses. And also, I probably shouldn't have done this. I tried to find what it would sound like for a body to hit the ground because I wanted to know what Frances was hearing. And let me tell you, I do not want to hear that sound ever again.
She witnesses this, what will become one of the most notorious labor catastrophes in American history. And it changes her forever in that moment. She will never be the same. She's been passionate about this stuff. She's been working on these things. But from this moment on, this is her life.
It was such a traumatic event that it was sort of the catalyst for the people to decide, okay, maybe we do need to listen to the reformers. We do need to change things. And Frances thought to herself, oh, God must have put me here for some reason. Because what are the odds, right, that she would be right there? And she took it as a reaffirmation of her personal mission to change things.
She once later proclaimed that that day was the day the New Deal was born.
Ah, wow.
Now,
that's a silver lining.
Wait a minute. Why? FDR wasn't there.
Oh.
Why did this launch the New Deal?
I mean, she's in the history books now for that. It's not FDR anymore.
Yeah,
there it is.
Because almost everything that I was taught in elementary school was FDR's greatest achievements.
Mm-hmm.
All of these landmark victories of the New Deal. Almost without exception, all of those were Francis.
Well, as we know from Alice Roosevelt, he was, what, 60% mush?
Yeah.
40% mush, 40% Francis Perkins, 20% yes. Eleanor.
Yes. That's pretty accurate, I would say. They were friends up until that point, general sort of social acquaintances. But in response to the shirtwaist fire, Perkins is appointed an investigator for the state's new factory investigating commission.
That's interesting that they appointed a woman.
This new agency's job is to improve working conditions for New Yorkers. And like many of the women who were placed in positions of power at this time, I don't think that the men who put her there really intended her to do it.
Uh-huh.
And they seemed a little startled when she actually did the thing that she had been charged with doing.
Yay.
But once Frances took on a task, that was going to happen. And her work would eventually lead to crucial new safety rules like, you have to have fire escapes in large buildings. Those fire escapes must reach the ground. You cannot chain workers into a building during work hours.
I mean, these are good ideas.
Very common sense yeah. ideas.
That's good, good.
They were not obvious at the time. These were shocking, controversial, wildly radical ideas that she had to push incredibly hard to get through. But the ambitious young governor of New York, this guy named Franklin Roosevelt, people might have heard of him, soon appointed her the state industrial commissioner. He was so impressed with this work she had done, and then made her labor secretary for the state of New York.
Wow.
And she's no longer that wide-eyed, naive young social worker just starting out who believed she could simply appeal to people's better natures and they would naturally do the right thing. She understood what was necessary here. She would famously drag legislators and public officials on midnight visits to the mills and the sweatshops, marching them directly through the middle of the chaos of the working floor and just casually pointing out things to them like, here's your workstation. You can't leave it for the next 12 hours.
Wow.
Forced them to lean out of the open window and stare down 12 floors to the ground below. There's your fire escape.
Amazing.
She knew how much her own experiences of actually being in these places, actually seeing and experiencing what these workers were going through, had changed her own views. And she made sure that these insulated, willfully oblivious men were forced to see and acknowledge what was happening. And it was incredibly effective.
Cool.
And Frances is a young woman in a very exciting city. Some of the really fun parts of the book where we get to be in New York City at the turn of the century, where everything is sort of throbbing with life and possibility, and immigrants are arriving by the thousands. And there's so much potential, and the American dream is in the air, but everything is really weighed down by poverty and exploitation. And we get to see the social parties in Greenwich Village. And we get to meet Sinclair Lewis, who was her very good friend and her sometimes paramour, or at least he thought he was her paramour. He fell in love with her and mentioned her in many of his books. She got to meet sort of millionaire socialites like Mary Harriman Rumsey, who would go on to be one of her best friends over the course of the next 25 years. And some people theorize perhaps more than friends. So there is a lot of fun and glamour in some ways in this book, even though it is the story of what might sound like dry political achievements. But it's about her incredibly rich life, everything from fancy parties with Russian diplomats to presidential elections and bohemian events in Manhattan. Oh, and I can't leave out the corrupt political bosses from Tammany Hall. I mean, that was super fun. You meet lots of real characters in this book. And I think I love Frances more for the fact that she loved the colorful people, even if they were flawed.
Registration is now open on What's-Her-Name's Yucatan Tour 2024. Join us in Mexico as we walk in the footsteps of Zazzle Ha, learn traditional Mayan cooking, tour Mayan ruins, snorkel with sea turtles, and so many more off-the-beaten-track adventures with our wonderful little band of kindred spirits. Spots are going fast, so sign up now on our website at whatshernamepodcast.com. We can't wait to see you there. Soon, Frances Perkins is the most prominent state labor official in the nation as she and Roosevelt begin searching for new ways to deal with rising unemployment in this whole depression thing that has recently kicked off. And when, fast forward a few years, that guy Roosevelt eventually becomes president of the United States, he asked Frances Perkins to be his Secretary of Labor.
That's awesome.
First woman ever to serve as a cabinet secretary in U.S. history.
And I think that she's Secretary of Labor is so remarkable because of all positions where you might shoehorn a woman in there, you wouldn't think it would be labor.
No, it is like, it's the manliest.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Maybe that's part of why she said no. She really liked her job and her life in New York.
Oh.
And she knew that that post would expose her to unprecedented levels of criticism and attack, that it would be exhausting physically, mentally, emotionally.
I would say no.
It is a terrible job.
Yeah. I would not.
I think that's why I admire Frances so much, because every single thing she did in her life is something I would never, ever do. I want to do it, but there is no way I would ever be willing to do these things that she has done.
Cool. She's taking one for the team.
It's so amazing.
Yeah.
Frances also knew something that nobody else, not even Roosevelt, knew. She knew that her husband, Paul, was in the hospital again with an unnamed condition, which today would almost definitely be diagnosed as bipolar disorder. He was not doing well. He had not been doing well for a long time. And she now had to supervise his care, as well as parenting her very headstrong, Alice Roosevelt-esque teenage daughter, Susanna, completely on her own. And do all of that without anyone finding out that her husband is in a mental hospital. Of course she can't do this job. But Roosevelt refused to let her say no. He kept coming back and back and back, pestering her, insisting that she had to take the job. He could not do this without her.
Interesting.
She knew that he was, in theory, committed to her ideals. They had been working together for a long time. She also wasn't as confident about his ability or determination to actually push through the things that she would want to do. So she made a list. In a letter she wrote, "I am going to shoot for the moon, and if he'll support me, I suppose I'd better do it."
Cool.
But she was pretty sure, and not so secretly hoping, that he would not agree to back her on this list, and then she'd be off the hook. So she arrived, sat down with Franklin Roosevelt, and outlined the list of things she would do if she was Secretary of Labor. Not things she would try to do or would want to do. Things she would do. And he had to commit now to fully back her on these things or she would not take the job. Here's a few items on the list. A 40-hour work week. A minimum wage. Unemployment compensation. Disability compensation, abolition of child labor, direct federal aid to the states for unemployment relief, a revitalized federal employment service, Social Security, and universal health insurance. Are you committed to do this with me? I mean, obviously that lists all of the most signature achievements of the New Deal.
Yeah.
The most impactful changes in 20th century American history.
Yeah.
That changed America forever.
It is an amazing list.
And it was all her.
It is like any, if you put that list in any other political context, or like say you had a candidate today with a list that bold, you'd be like, okay, but you could maybe achieve one-tenth of that. But
yeah, it's nonsense. Yeah, yeah. It's absolute nonsense.
To think you could make such changes.
Pie in the sky. Yeah. Silliness. Mm. Any one of those is an outrageous. Yeah. And Roosevelt said, yes, good. Mm-hmm. Let's do that. Mm-hmm. And told her to run with that agenda.
He said, okay, but not Social Security. I mean, that's crazy.
Everything else, totally on board. He would back her all the way. Even then, he knew who he was hiring. He told her, you care about this. You believe in this thing. You will see that something comes of it, and you must not delay.
Wow. Well, you can say one thing for him. He's not afraid of powerful women.
He was self-aware enough about his shortcomings. He knew that he did not have the kind of stiff moral backbone that some might hope he had. And he knew that he maybe had a tendency to make politically convenient decisions over ethically correct ones. So he deliberately installs people like Francis around him. He knows that Francis is going to hold him accountable. And I have to believe he knew exactly what he was doing there. He knew that this was a way he could hold himself accountable to what he wishes he could be, maybe. And I really do admire him for that.
Fascinating.
The only thing on that list that she did not get was universal health care.
What if she had? What if she had?
I write about a lot of founding figures, and almost all of them, well, let me say all of them, have some sort of problematic issue in their background, particularly if they rise to the level of president. I am of the belief that you do not become president without having done some skullduggery. And FDR certainly had his moments of terrible things. So when Francis Perkins and FDR pushed for a new relationship between citizens and their government, she certainly played the role of his conscience a lot of the times, along with other women that he valued, including Eleanor. FDR was not going to do something if it was going to get him unelected, but if he could find a way around the political realities, he would. But he taught her in a lot of ways how to be a much more ruthless political animal. He has a natural instinct for it. He would often exasperate her, but she really admired him anyway.
And so she sets to work.
Cool.
And there is no more committed worker. 40-hour work week for everyone else. 400-hour work week for her.
Mm.
She would lie in bed late at night working on a bill or a plan or an issue, and would keep a glass of cold water by the bed so that she could drip cold water onto her eyelids to keep herself awake longer.
Wow.
She was relentless
when
she believed that something was important. And she knew what she was up against. She was questioned constantly because of her gender by the media, by the public, but by the men in the room, by everyone she's supposed to be working with, by the people working for her. Everyone is at least a little bit upset that she is there.
But she was able to read the room. She could decide in a glance whether a man would respond best to her behaving like his mother, or perhaps slamming down a bottle of bourbon on the table and drinking him under it.
She had a very specific and very unusual strategy anytime she was facing trouble with a particular man. She would learn about his relationship with his mother, and she dispensed this advice to other women working in male-dominated fields.
Wow.
If he liked his mom, find out what she was like and mimic that relationship. Create that maternal vibe, and he will want to help you. If he did not like his mom, find out why and become the opposite. Did he see his mom as cold and distant and removed? Be effusive in your praise. Be the admiring mom that he never had and always wanted. Did he see his mom as controlling and over-emotional? Be calm, rational, detached. Give him the empowering, peaceful mom he always wanted. It's so gross. It's so frustrating. It's also genius. And it absolutely worked. It worked incredibly well.
It's the exact reason I could never be in politics. That's just, it was so, but that's politics. That's what a good politician who wants to move mountains. Can do.
She was very good at this game. So she's leaning into this grumpy, matronly thing that her mother, you know, pushed on her at 10 years old. You'll never be a beauty. Wear this grumpy hat. And she seems to have leaned into that as hard as possible here. She's playing that comfortable, frumpy mother figure that the nation could accept.
Yeah, I'm sure that gave her a lot of power.
She's the exact same age or younger than all of the men in the room, but they call her Ma Perkins, which she hated, by the way, but
interesting.
She knew it was a man's world, and she knew that she was not just the first woman in the room. She's almost always the only woman in the room. And she learns how to play the game.
Harold Ickes, another cabinet member who she served with, he was often complaining about Frances and how she would go on in cabinet meetings, according to him. And he said, you know, she's lecturing again, and none of us are listening, except for the president always listens to her.
Well, that's all she needs is Roosevelt listening to her. But when it's clear that she needs to get everyone online, she can make it happen. When it became obvious to her they were not going to get an agreement on Social Security by Roosevelt's arbitrary Christmas deadline, and everyone was still fighting and squabbling and just making her miserable, Frances invited the entire cabinet over to a dinner party. They arrive. She leads them into the dining room, plunks a giant bottle of scotch down on the table, and announces that no one will be leaving until the work is done. And by the end of the evening, Social Security was done and they met the deadline. And I think this proves something important. They complain, they whine, but when it comes down to it, these men listen to her. You know, she may grandly proclaim nobody leaves, but of course she can't prevent any of these men from leaving.
Yeah.
That they don't leave, that they stay and get to work and actually do the things she is demanding they do, proves that she really does have the authority and the respect of these men when she needs it. They might be really angry that a woman is in the room and that it's specifically this woman. But when she picks her battles, she wins.
I love it.
Frances is also having to navigate her relationship with the other most important woman in FDR's life, the other half maybe of his conscience, Eleanor. And that was fraught with perils for Frances.
I loved exploring the interesting relationship between Frances and Eleanor because they were allies, they were friends, but they weren't close friends, in part because they had very different temperaments. Frances is so buttoned up and such a New Englander. And Eleanor gains a lot of her political power and personal connection with people by sharing her personal experiences. And to Frances, she's a horrible oversharer, and she just can't believe that she's willing to put herself out like that.
Eleanor is not afraid to discuss personal things with friends.
Uh-huh.
And she is constantly trying to talk to Francis about really awkward things. Francis is wildly uncomfortable in conversations like this in the first place. Franklin is her boss. Her boss's wife keeps trying to tell her about her boss's affairs with other women.
And sometimes she thinks, I need to, you know, chew my arm off to get out of this room because Eleanor is telling me things I cannot handle right now.
This is an unbelievably impossible situation for her to navigate here. It's an HR nightmare.
And she feels terrible about it. But, you know, Francis was Franklin's friend. She liked Eleanor. Eleanor liked her. They were allies for their entire lives. But ultimately, if Francis was going to pick a side, it was always going to be Franklin.
Francis Perkins is one of the only cabinet secretaries who will remain in the cabinet through all three of FDR's administrations. She was relentless. She was principled. Her stuff got done. The Fair Labor Standards Act, the National Labor Relations Act, Social Security, fire codes, child labor laws, minimum wage, weekends.
She is everywhere around us. If we look at our daily lives, every American life has been touched by her. For example, if you, wherever you are listening to this, if you look overhead and there is a fire sprinkler system, you can thank Frances Perkins. If you had a fun weekend, you can thank Frances Perkins. If you went to school as a child instead of working at a factory, you can thank Frances Perkins. If you ate at a restaurant and there were not rat droppings in your food, you can thank Frances Perkins. And that's all besides if you or anyone in your family has collected Social Security payments, you can thank Frances Perkins.
Historians have pointed out we got most of what we think of as normal in the U.S. now, the modern era U.S., is all her.
Is her construction. Absolutely.
It's we live in Frances Perkins' America.
Uh-huh.
Or as I often, only slightly tongue-in-cheek, say, everything good about America came from Frances Perkins.
Well, I was going to say, if you hate big government, you can blame Frances Perkins.
Yep, but you can also note that poverty rates were cut in half because of specifically Frances Perkins' policies. She is the principal architect of the New Deal, and everybody knew it at the time. The public was aware of this. It's not that she's just now getting credit. Everyone then knew, and then we all forgot. Collier's Magazine at the time said it's not so much the Roosevelt New Deal as the Perkins New Deal.
Yeah.
That was a vicious attack on Roosevelt, but they knew what was going on.
It's the people who wrote the textbooks in the 80s when they were like, we need to simplify this. This is all under the FDR umbrella.
I'm going to tell a little bit of a personal story about this, because my family, unlike Frances Perkins's revolutionary ancestors, my family is comprised mostly of relatively recent immigrants to America. My family came from Europe in the early 20th century, fleeing poverty and persecution there. And what I heard from my grandparents was a revolution that was important to them, and that was the New Deal. They all lived through the Great Depression, and they had stories to tell about that. Sometimes they would tell stories about capers they had, you know, trying to get fallen fruit from a horse-drawn carriage that might have dropped something as it went by, or foraging in the woods for frogs and squirrels and mushrooms so that they could get something to eat. But there was a more tragic story, and that is that my great uncle, who was about 16 at the time, tried to steal some coal from a passing train so that he could keep the family warm during a very cold Rochesterian winter in upstate New York. Unfortunately, he was killed during that attempt, and this really scarred the whole family. He was my grandfather's favorite brother. And this was such a tragic incident that he named his son, my father, after that uncle had died. all of my grandparents would talk about FDR in the most glowing terms. He was a god to them. He had saved the family because of the New Deal. And FDR was also inspirational for another reason in our family. My father was one of the last children to contract polio before the vaccines, and he had a paralyzed leg. And so my grandmother would always tell him, well, you know, if Franklin Delano Roosevelt could become president with polio, then you have no excuse. You have to make good with your life. And of course, my dad did. He went on to lead a very wonderful life and is one of the most resilient men I know. So always I heard about FDR and how I wouldn't be here without him. But it never had occurred to me that the woman behind these programs was Frances Perkins. And once I realized that she was really sort of the architect of many of the New Deal programs, I knew that I owed her a very personal debt of gratitude. And I really wanted to help carry on her legacy in some tiny way, to do it some justice and to help people know what she stood for. Frances is really the first heroine I have ever written about who does not have much in her background that I had to sort of cringe about or address in that way. So I'm thrilled about having someone who is almost universally noble.
You say I've got her on a pedestal? Well, in fact, Frances Perkins is a literal saint. In 2009, she was named a saint in the Episcopal Church.
Cool.
So she is the first heroine I have ever written about who is an actual saint. And that's delightful. I think the child labor issue was probably the most important issue to her. But it is not her key achievement. What she did in persuading FDR to have a Social Security Act was revolutionary, and it impacted everything else because people think of Social Security as just like sort of old age pensions. But in fact, it has broader benefits than that to orphans and disabled children and widows and so on and so forth. So it was a bigger program than anything she had conceived before. He probably was quite amenable to the idea in principle, but he thought politically it was a loser. So she had to make it a winner for him. And she did. I think she was quite aware that this was a monumental and historic achievement, the achievement of her lifetime, a culmination of decades in public service. And yet on the day that this was signed, she found out that her husband had escaped from his mental institution.
This should have been the greatest, most important day of her career. And she has to wait out the few hours until the signing, make the public appearances, stand directly behind FDR as he signs her bill, and then get straight on a train to New York and spend the entire night wandering in the dark trying to find her missing husband. Mm.
And so if you look at the pictures from that day, you see that she has sort of a haunted look in her eyes, like, I have to get out of here. I have to go find my husband. He's in danger.
Because is it still a secret?
It's still, Roosevelt knows by this point. Mm. Nobody knows.
Too bad.
What her life is. She is jumping back and forth on weekends. He's in institutions, in and out. Her daughter is becoming increasingly erratic.
So she was always struggling with the personal and the political at the same time. And how she managed it, I do not know.
At the time of Roosevelt's death in 1945, Perkins is the longest serving labor secretary in U.S. history. Harry Truman asked her to stay on in his administration to work in the Civil Service Commission, not in the cabinet.
After FDR died, Harry Truman was trying to figure out who he would or would not keep in the cabinet. And he asked if, after serving with Frances Perkins for 7 years, that these men would be comfortable with the woman in the cabinet. And they said no.
Wow.
When her husband died in 1957, she finally retired from government, was immediately recruited to teach at Cornell, and taught there until her death in 1965.
Huh.
I asked Stephanie Dre if she thought Frances was satisfied with what she had achieved at the end of her life.
Do you think she was satisfied in the end with what she had accomplished? Or I see your smile and we're both thinking the same thing. Like, literally never satisfied.
Correct. She was just like Hamilton. There was always something else that she could fix or advocate for. And that's why I kind of liked the epilogue that I read in the book, where she sits down with John Kennedy and she's still giving him the business about things he needs to do and improve. She never stopped advocating for the United States. Why would she? She was going to work for the people until her last breath, and that's what she did. One of her highest compliments that she could give, according to her grandson, is if she called someone a solid citizen. She wanted to be an example of what a great American was. And ultimately, she was a great American. She's a colossus.
Huge thanks to Stephanie Dre. I highly recommend getting your hands on a copy of Becoming Madam Secretary. It's a wonderful novel. It really brings Frances Perkins to life. I think readers will fall in love with her in this book. There's also a wonderful biography of Frances Perkins by Kirsten Downey called The Woman Behind the New Deal that I also highly recommend. You can visit our website at What's Her Name Podcast, and there you'll find all sorts of links, resources, and more. You can also follow Stephanie Dre at her website, which is linked on our website. There you can sign up for her newsletter, follow her on her book tour, get free books, all kinds of great stuff there.
You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, where we post lots of photos each week.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on whichever platform you listen. It makes a huge difference in helping people find us. Music in this episode was provided by Aaron Kenny, Kevin McLeod, Amanda Setlick-Wilson, Mary Lou Williams, and Dan Bowden.
Our theme song was composed and performed by Daniel Foster Smith.
Our intern is Katie Boucher.
What's Her Name is produced by Olivia Mickle and Katie Nelson, and this episode was edited by Olivia Mickle.